person of myself, Charlie Gordon, microphone Jonah Howe. Jonah.
Hello.
Hello!
On the date of this episode's release, the 27th of January 2021, it is National Holocaust Memorial Day. And now, 76 years on from the end of the Holocaust and the end of the Second World War, it's more important than ever to inform ourselves and educate others on the dark past, the really dark past of Nazi Germany. So in today's history section, we are going to take a look at the deep-rooted anti-Semitism in the Nazi Party, what it meant, the roots of it, the aftermath, and ultimately the purge of the Jewish people in the Holocaust, which led to more than 6 million deaths. And joining us today, we are delighted to welcome Mr. Martin Winston. Hello, Martin.
Hello, Jonah. Thank you for having me.
So, Martin, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I am Senior Historical Advisor to the Holocaust Educational Trust, which is a charity which has been around for 33 years now, which works across the UK to educate people about the Holocaust, working with Holocaust survivors and training teachers, producing educational resources. And the Holocaust, I think, is fair to say, is something that's central to the history curriculum across the UK. And we engage with literally tens of thousands of students each year and thousands of teachers.
Okay, that's really great. And this is our aim in today's episode, to educate, to teach, to inform people a little bit more about the Holocaust and what life was like to be Jewish, to be gay, to be mentally handicapped or disabled in Nazi Germany. So let's begin. Throughout their 12 years in power, the Nazis persecuted any group that they thought challenged Nazi ideals. So as we know, Hitler had this fantasized idealist reality, and some people played no part in those dreams. Homosexuals were seen as a threat to Nazi ideas about family life. The mentally handicapped were a threat to Nazi ideas about Germans being a perfect master race. And gypsies and Jews were thought to be inferior people. So, Charlie.
Yes.
One thing we've got to make clear is that the Nazis didn't invent anti-Semitism. Throughout Europe, for hundreds of years, Jewish people had experienced discrimination, you know, wherever they had gone.
Yeah.
The exile from England, the exile from Spain,
Russia,
examples.
Everywhere.
And they were often treated unjustly in courts or forced to live in sectioned areas of cities such as ghettos.
Yes.
So, Charlie, I'll hand over to you. Talk to me a little bit about early anti-Semitism in Nazi Germany.
So as soon as the Nazis took power in 1933, Hitler began to sort of mobilize the full powers of the state against the Jews. So they were immediately banned from the civil service and a variety of public services such as broadcasting and teaching. At the same time, SA troops were boycotting Jewish shops and businesses, which were marked with the Star of David. And Goebbels's propaganda experts and his propaganda machine just bombarded German children and families with anti-Jewish messages. And as well as that, in daily life, Jews faced discrimination. They were refused jobs or services in shops. And in schools, Jewish children were humiliated and then, of course, segregated. So, Martin, can you outline as to what caused this growing trend of anti-Semitism across Germany?
That's a very good question. I think, as you alluded to, it drew on a very long history. Anti-Semitism, sadly, has been a part of European life for a millennium at least. And in a way, Nazism could not have made such headway if there'd not been that sort of pre-existing prejudice in significant parts of Europe. But at the same time, I think it's fair to say that anti-Semitism mutated through its history. In medieval Europe, at the Jonah mentioned, for example, the expulsion of the Jews from England and then later from Spain. You know, it was very much a religious phenomenon. Jews were not Christians. They were seen as the enemies of Christianity, so were persecuted. By the early 20th century, anti-Semitism in many parts of Europe, and certainly this was true of Nazi anti-Semitism, had nothing to do with religion, essentially. It was based on a racial worldview, which not only saw Jews as racially inferior, as the Nazis saw certain other groups as well, but actually saw Jews as singularly evil and threatening. Yeah. So the Nazi anti-Semitism drew on this sort of racist worldview which existed, but particularly stressed that idea that Jews were essentially responsible for all of the misfortunes of Germany, maybe of humanity, and were an enemy of humanity, essentially. So it was always likely once such a virulently anti-Semitic movement came to power that it would introduce anti-Semitic measures. And in addition to the various legal and sort of social measures that you've mentioned, there was also the continual and sort of growing threat of violence as well. Everyday life for many Jews in Germany in small towns, as well as the big cities, was characterized by the threat of violence from the stormtroopers of the SA. So I think it's, you know, it was always inevitable that once the Nazis came to power, that this would lead to some form of anti-Semitic agitation. Just what form it would take, I think the Nazis were making it up as they went along, to be perfectly honest. And in part, they were seeing, I think, what they could get away with. And I think an issue that you touched on, particularly when you talked about, for example, with schools, or Jews being excluded in various ways from life, is it wasn't just coming from Hitler in Berlin or even from local Nazi party leaders. Yeah. Unfortunately, one of the disturbing things that this period of history raises is the willingness of ordinary people to be a part of this. And it's hard to know how many of them had pre-existing anti-Semitic prejudices, how far it was simply, you know, unfortunately, I think a really big factor. You mentioned the civil service and other professions. You know, there were people who thought, well, if all of these people get sacked, then that's going to benefit my career. Yeah. So I think for some people, a mixture of prejudice or ambition or greed contributed to a willingness to be a part of this process.
Yeah, one thing is clear is that Adolf Hitler's incredibly powerful oratory skills, his speaking ability, was something that indoctrinated the everyday worker in Germany. The belief that this sort of Aryan Germanic superiority it vaxed itself in a this kind of kind of just everyday life of Nazi Germany, that Jews were inferior and everything. And I think one important set of laws that occurred in Nuremberg in 1935 were the Nuremberg race laws. Mm-hmm. So effectively,
I was going to say, with Martin's point on the actions of the ordinary people and your point, Charlie, of Hitler's impressive oratory skills, what the Nazis used very effectively and to their advantage was the idea of negative cohesion. The Nazis could relate to any problem of any German anywhere and blame them on three main sources: democracy, communism, and the Jewish people. And so quickly, these people are misled, or whatever you want to say, into believing that whatever was going wrong in their lives was because of democracy, was because of the Jewish people running the businesses, was because of the Bolshevist communist threat. And this appealed to Germans in their millions and saw Nazi support increase drastically, and also saw a growing disliking and hatred to everything the Nazis disliked.
Yeah.
But back to the Nuremberg race laws, Charlie.
Yeah, I was going to ask Martin if he could sort of outline to our listeners what these laws meant for Jews.
Sure. So technically, I mean, the Nuremberg laws were two laws that were passed. Well, passed is maybe the wrong word because it implies sort of debate and voting. Two laws that were issued in September of 1935. And essentially, the impact of them was to isolate Jews from German society. One law essentially removed the rights of citizenship from German Jews, which enabled a lot of later measures to be taken against them. And the other law did various things, but essentially made it illegal for a Jew to marry or to have sexual relations with a non-Jew. And I think what you see is the impetus there was partly coming from, as it were, ordinary Nazi Party members who were frustrated that there hadn't been more anti-Semitic measures. They'd been, you know, it was core of the Nazi Party program to drive the Jews out of German life, and there'd been various laws which you mentioned earlier. But I think there were some of the more radical elements of the Nazi Party which were expecting more drastic action. And so it's partly in response to that pressure that the Nazi leadership issued these laws. But as I say, they're significant not just because of what they said themselves, but because by denying the rights of citizenship, they made it possible for further legal measures to be taken against Jews in the years ahead.
Yeah, so that's right. And of course, in 1936, we had the Olympic Games held in Berlin, in which Goebbels, to his great, I suppose, his great happiness, that he could issue his propaganda and make huge stadiums and really modernize or make people see Germany as a very modern and sophisticated country. But for a brief period after, in the weeks and during the 1936 Olympic Games held in Berlin, the Nazi regime actually moderated its anti-Jewish attacks and even removed some signs saying Jews unwelcome from public places, as obviously Hitler did not want to receive international criticism of his thoughts and his ideologies. And of course, in the Olympic Games, no Jews were allowed to compete, and the Germans won a lot of medals, but the famous story is that, you know, this athlete Jesse Owens, who won I think 4 gold medals, who was American and he was black, you know, it kind of was a big shock to Goebbels and Hitler and almost proved them wrong. But yeah, once again, obviously Jews were at this point really starting to feel the full force of the regime and the entire nation that was set out to get them. And obviously these laws continued up until Kristallnacht. So Jonah, tell us a bit about Kristallnacht.
In November 1938, a young Jewish man killed a German diplomat in Paris. And the Nazis used this as an excuse to launch a violent revenge on the Jews. Now, this isn't the first time we've seen one person carry out an act that the Nazis take to blame the entire race or ideologies of that person. We looked at the communist van der Lubbe and the burning down the Reichstag. That was just one communist, but Hitler used that to create the conspiracy theory that all communists were attempting to overthrow Germany, and hence action had to be taken immediately. We see a similar thing here. Plainclothes SS troopers were issued with pickaxes and hammers and the addresses of Jewish businesses. And quite simply, they ran riots, smashing up Jewish shops and workplaces. 91 Jewish people were murdered. Hundreds of synagogues were burned. 20,000 Jews were taken to concentration camps, and thousands more fled the country. And like I said, this event became known as Kristallnacht, or the Night of Broken Glass.
Yeah. So, well, Martin, do you think you could tell us the effect of Kristallnacht on you know, the country and the attitudes towards Jews and how it further became more extreme.
Absolutely. I think it has that impact in a number of ways. Firstly, and this was the purpose of Kristallnacht, which, to be honest, you know, was clearly planned. If there had not been this assassination in Paris, so there's a general feeling that, you know, some sort of big violent nationwide event was coming. But essentially, there's both the pogrom itself, so pogrom is a sort of attack on a Jewish community, which was national, which, as you say, was devastating in terms of its impact. And it was followed in the days immediately afterwards by a massive wave of new discriminatory laws, which went much further than those that had existed already. So essentially removing Jews from the economy altogether, from education, from any remaining professions which were open to them. And the main thing that this did, and which it was intended to achieve, was to force most Jews out of Germany. In the early 30s, maybe what the Nazis had been trying to do was to isolate Jews from society, to essentially remove the rights that other citizens had. But by the late 30s, the aim was just to get them out of Germany.
Yeah.
So the, you know, very clear idea was this would encourage emigration by making life so uncomfortable that Jews would leave. And they did. By the time the war broke out, most German Jews had emigrated, and most of them emigrated in the 10 months between Kristallnacht and the start of the war. But in terms of the wider German population, I think as much as anything else, I mean, what really comes out of the testimonies of Jews who were in Germany at the time of Kristallnacht was, in some cases, the hostility of their neighbours, their fellow Germans, but perhaps maybe more often just the indifference. I think after, you know, 5.5 years of Nazi rule, people, most, not all by any means, but most people, I think, had come to accept, in many cases, to support the Nazi regime and to go along with this idea of Jews being somehow no longer part of society. So I think, you know, in a way, what Kristallnacht showed was the potential for violence, the willingness of the people to an extent to go along with it. I mean, a lot of the caveat is a lot of the monitoring of public opinion in Nazi Germany suggests that people were uneasy about the Kristallnacht, but primarily that they were uneasy because of the lawlessness of it, of the damage to property. Yeah. And actually there were people within the Nazi regime like Goering who shared that idea as well, who thought that it was a mistake. So it wasn't necessarily so much human sympathy as just concern about the violence. So in a way it showed that, you know, that there was not going to be a significant amount of opposition to radical action being taken against Germany's Jews.
Yeah, so you make a good point about that. I think, you know, Goering being worried about the economic problems that would come out of these attacks on Jews, smashing up shops, causing havoc in the streets. Germany was, I wouldn't call it chaos, but definitely there was a lot of violence taking place between the SA and the SS, and, you know, beating up Jews. And once the war started, and after invading Poland, following the Nazi-Soviet pact, in which we discussed last episode, the Nazis set up about, you know, Germanizing Western Poland, and this meant transporting Poles from their homes and replacing them with German settlers. And a lot of Poles died. But more importantly, Polish Jews were rounded up and were transported to the big cities. And here they were herded up in places called ghettos. So, Martin, do you think you could discuss the impact of the ghettos?
Yeah, sure. And actually, those two things are linked, the deportation of Poles and increasingly forcing Jews into ghettos, because the outbreak of the war is the crucial moment in, obviously, in a lot of respects with the Nazi Party, but particularly with racial policy, because this now gave them the opportunity to acquire the so-called Lebensraum, the living space, which was so central to their ideology, and to create what they saw as a sort of like racial utopia in the conquered territories. And so these grandiose schemes were developed by the SS for moving millions of people around. And the initial plan was essentially that more or less Western Poland would be for the Germans, as you suggested. Poles and Jews would be removed from there. Poles would have some sort of, more or less, some sort of in-between zone with appallingly low living standards, and then Jews would be dumped somewhere. They would be dumped in Eastern Poland. That was the initial plan. Then as the war developed, various other ideas that came along, but essentially that Jews would be sent somewhere where they would be left to die. But those plans kept on being frustrated by reality, by logistical and military problems. So in the end, the Nazis decided instead to put them into ghettos. The ghetto policy is a bit misunderstood, to be honest, because it was never coherent. It was very inconsistent. Ghettos were created in different places at different times. So most ghettos in Poland were actually created in 41 or 42. But the most notable ones in Łódź and Warsaw, the two biggest Polish cities with the biggest Jewish populations, were created in 1940. And essentially what happened with every ghetto that was created is far more people than could be accommodated into a particular area were crammed in. And that inevitably led to disease as a result of overcrowding. It led to starvation as a lack of food. And what's one of the interesting things about the creation of ghettos in Poland is it wasn't just coming from the SS leadership. It was also coming from lower level German officials. For example, you had a lot of doctors and public health officials in Poland, German officials, who were arguing that somehow Jews genetically were predisposed towards spreading diseases like typhus, so they had to be segregated from the rest of the population. And if you cram 400,000 people into a small area in the centre of a European capital city, as happened in Warsaw, you're going to get diseases like typhus. That just happens with that level of overcrowding. So then those public officials would say, well, look, we told you so. So in the ghettos themselves, before mass extermination started, between, say, 1940 and 1942, in Poland, well over 100,000 Jews died in the ghettos of disease, starvation, overwork, and so on. So that in and of itself became a part of what was beginning to be a process of murder. Yeah. But also the fact that the Nazis still didn't know what to do with these Jews and were alarmed about diseases spreading outside the ghetto and so on also led them to then begin to consider maybe more radical measures for dealing with them.
Following up on the ghettos, in 2018, I was lucky enough to visit Budapest of Hungary. And of course, the Nazi occupation of Hungary was quite a significant one, to say the least. And during my time in Budapest, I spent quite a lot of it within the old walls of the Jewish ghetto. And you talk about the size of these ghettos. It's so hard to visualize it in your head, but when I was there, they really, really are tiny, like only a matter of only a few streets wide. And to think of the thousands of people living in
this,
the size of the ghettos were nowhere near suitable for the numbers of people intended to be put in there. And it was really shocking to see that and experience that when I was there.
I'd just say quickly as well on the case of Budapest, which where the ghetto was created very late in the war in 1944, and this is maybe something we can come back to a bit later, that in that particular case the ghetto wasn't created by the Germans, it was created by the Arrow Cross, Hungarian fascists, who'd taken power in Hungary by that stage. And I think that's something for us always to bear in mind when we're talking, once we get to the wartime period, for the Holocaust to be possible, for mass murder on a continental scale, the Germans didn't have the resources or the knowledge to be able to carry that out on their own. So as a sort of pan-European genocide, the Holocaust required pan-European involvement. So a key theme which runs through everything that happened in the war is the involvement of sometimes governments, sometimes ordinary citizens, who were non-German.
Yeah, now that's a very good point, and it's very interesting to it's a very interesting topic to enlighten ourselves. Just to imagine the harrowing experience of these these Jews who lived like this for years in other camps, such as ghettos such as Terenstadt in Czech Republic, in which there were, I know personally, I've seen a couple of documentaries about it. There were starvation, hunger, disease, everything, the whole package all fit into one tiny half a mile of streets. I've got a memoir here from a man called Ed Herman, who lived in the Warsaw ghetto. He says, "I saw much suffering. The ghetto was very overcrowded. There was a typhoid epidemic. Many buildings, including where I lived with my grandfather, were under quarantine. During the winter, I was very cold. To keep warm, I stayed in bed, covered by whatever I could find. I was continuously hungry. I was dreaming of the White Kaiser rolls that I had for breakfast before the war in Katowice. In the ghetto, young starving children were begging for food. Their bodies were lying in the streets. I had relatives who lived from the notorious Pawiak prison run by the Gestapo, where executions took place daily. On one visit to their house, crossing a checkpoint manned by the police, I was beaten up by a policeman for no reason at all, but simply because I was there." So this is another example of Jews being persecuted just for their plain existence. And again, the terrible experiences that people would have endured in these ghettos. So, swiftly moving on. In 1941, Germany decided to invade the USSR. Hitler had turned on Stalin. Within weeks, the Nazis found themselves in control of 3 million Soviet Jews, in addition to the Jews in all the other countries they had conquered. German forces had orders to round up and shoot Communist Party activists and their Jewish supporters. And these executions were carried out by some special SS units called Einsatzgruppen. Interesting pronunciation. And by the autumn of 1941, mass shootings were taking place all over occupied Eastern Europe. And in Germany, at this point, all Jews were ordered to wear the Star of David on their clothing to mark them out. So this is just, further. This is really what the road to murder, the active the murder. On the road to the final solution. Martin, what do you make of this?
Absolutely. I think one of the problems, which I suspect you've probably addressed in previous podcasts with the Nazi regime, is the way Hitler took decisions, things were generally not written down. So we don't know precisely when certain decisions were taken, but we know over the course of 1941, there's this extreme radicalization of Nazi policy, which leads to mass murder. By the end of the year, at the latest, the decision to murder all European Jews. And the invasion of the Soviet Union, as you say, was crucial. In the Nazi worldview, Jonah mentioned earlier, what did the Nazis blame for the problems of the world, and communism being very much a part of that. But ultimately, it comes back to this anti-Semitic worldview, because the Nazis referred to Judeo-Bolshevism, that Jewishness and communism were inextricably linked. So this was to be a war unlike any other. And from the invasion onwards, on the 22nd of June, there's this escalation of killing very, very quickly. So that initially the Einsatzgruppen were murdering predominantly Jewish men of working age, because they were thought to be the most dangerous, the ones who might be communist agitators. But then within weeks, certainly by about August or September, murdering entire Jewish communities. And in part, this reveals something quite important about how the Nazi regime worked, which was, Hitler was not a hands-on dictator. Hitler left it up to subordinates to come up with the answers to whatever questions he set them. And so there were always people seeking to impress the Nazi leadership. So you get this process that historians have referred to as cumulative radicalization. Basically, Einsatzgruppe commanders were given quite vague orders to kill communists, to kill Jews in party positions. And then it was just, there's this famous bit in the Einsatzgruppe orders where it says, etc. How do you interpret what basically seems to have given the commanders open-ended orders? And they chose to interpret them by trying to kill as many people as they possibly could. And what they found as the summer of 41 went on was not only could they killed large numbers of people themselves, but they were able to get ordinary German policemen, to get local people in places like Lithuania and Latvia to take part in the murders as well. So they could kill even more.
Yeah.
So I think that's one thing. The other thing is the course of the war in the Soviet Union in 1941 influences how the Nazis perceive what they do to the Jews. And there's some disagreement amongst historians about exactly what the pattern there is. But essentially, most historians would tend to say, as they began to suffer setbacks, military setbacks in the autumn of 41, then increasingly the idea was you take that out on the Jews. Because the Jews are behind Bolshevism. So if you can't defeat Stalin, then you can defeat the millions of poor Polish and Lithuanian and Belarusian Jews who supposedly are controlling Stalin, which obviously was nonsense, but they genuinely believed that.
Yeah, so I have another question. Do you think that many of the Nazis involved in the party wanted the Jews to be dead, or do they want them to leave the country, simply leave the country and leave them alone and get out the Greater German Reich?
Well, that's the key question, out of the Greater German Reich, because the Greater German Reich kept on getting bigger and bigger. So I think in the 30s, you know, up to the war, the ambition was just to force the Jews to emigrate.
Yeah,
but obviously, even before the war, with the acquisition of Austria and then the Czech territories, that brought more Jews under German control. Once the war was underway, the aim initially was to remove them somewhere. So I mentioned earlier, initially to somewhere in eastern Poland in 1940, after the defeat of France, they developed the idea of sending the Jews to Madagascar, the French colony.
Yeah.
And then the plan even in 1941, the plan was to deport them to remote areas of the Soviet Union. Once the Soviet Union was beaten, send them to the Arctic Circle, maybe send them to the concentration camps of the Soviet Gulag. And that would mean most of them would die. But it would be, as it were, sort of death by attrition, by leaving people to starve.
Not actually.
Rather than killing them immediately. And when it became clear they weren't going to do that because the Soviets were not going to be beaten immediately, increasingly in the autumn of 1941, then the Nazis started to say, we just have to kill them now. And just one other thing to mention in that context. In January of 1939, Hitler had made a speech to the Reichstag where he'd said that if international Jewry, if the Jews of the world should succeed once more in plunging the nations of the earth into world war, because if there was a world war, it would be the Jews' fault,
yeah,
in Hitler's worldview, then the result would not be the Bolshevization of the earth, but the annihilation of the Jewish people in Europe. And what that's generally seen as meaning is not saying that Hitler at that stage was planning this, but there was a threat to America. He talked about international Jewish financiers in and outside of Europe. And so if America got involved and turned this into a world war, as it happened in the First World War, then the Jews would suffer. And then, of course, in December of 1941, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. Hitler then declared war on America. So Germany declared war on America, which in Hitler's eyes meant that the international Jewish financiers in New York had started a war, even though he was the one who had done.
Yeah.
So in the week after that announcement, Hitler had meetings with lots of key Nazi leaders where he kept on reminding them of this so-called prophecy. If there's world war, the Jews die. So I think over the autumn of 1941, the military situation had pushed not just Hitler, but I think all Nazi leaders, senior Nazi leaders, and many lower level officials to the idea that the Jews were going to be murdered and murdered very quickly.
Yes.
Yeah, Charlie, I just want to go back to your previous question about, did all Germans 100% want the death of Jews? Did all Nazi leaders want the death of Jews? And when I was first looking into this subject, however many years ago, it did seem on the surface that all Jews were killed and all Jews were wanted to be killed, and there was no hesitation about that. But I actually listened to a really interesting speech by Heinrich Himmler addressing the final solution and the persecution of all Jews. And he makes it clear to the audience, who are standard members of the German public, that it's an uneasy thing to think about, that as he was talking about the killing of Jews, he recognized how people in the audience were beginning to feel uncomfortable, and he had to justify his reasons, and almost, I don't know how to describe it, it's almost as if people in Germany recognized this was not a moral thing.
No,
and Himmler himself recognized that other people were recognizing it wasn't a moral thing. What I'm trying to say is...
They see it to be morally wrong. And of course, we know that there were Gentiles and people who were cooperating with Jews to try and hide them. You know, Anne Frank, for example, Oskar Schindler, who Schindler's List. Most people have seen that film. And of course, you know, there were many people of morality and people who did not believe that this was the right thing. But the regime, the police state, the SS, the SA, everything that created this fear of doing anything remotely wrong, these kind of, you know, the living in fear caused people to just be forced to cooperate, of course, if you weren't Jewish.
Yeah.
I think on that note, a couple of things as well. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, when Himmler thought the Holocaust was moral, and he knew that other people might not. I mean, he famously in 1943 described the Holocaust as an unwritten and never to be written page of glory. So something to be proud of, but a realization other people might not be proud. And I think, you know, it's fair to say within the German public, there was, you know, some people who were hostile. There were very, very few protests against the Holocaust, which is interesting because there were protests in Germany against the murder of people with disabilities. So people were willing to mobilize about that, not about the murder of Jews. But I think at the same time, just on the note about terror, I mean, the terror state is a key factor in terms of making the Holocaust possible. I think it's important to say at the same time, in terms of what maybe made someone participate in the Holocaust, you know, after the war, when a very small proportion of the perpetrators faced justice or the prospect of justice, they always said, I was just obeying orders, and if I hadn't done this, I would have been shot myself. And that was a complete lie. Historians and prosecutors have failed to find a single example of someone being punished for the refusal to take part in the murder of Jews. What they have found is many cases where men were given a choice. Because I think, you know, particularly with the police, who were actually the majority of the murderers, certainly in the mass shootings in the Holocaust, they were usually middle-aged, they had families of their own, and particularly killing children is obviously not a pleasant experience. So there are a number of cases where people refused to take part in the murder of children, or their commanding officers said to them, if you don't feel you can do this, you don't have to. So there was never any punishment. So I think there's an interesting thing, therefore, which raises really deep questions to which I don't know the answer about human nature, about what makes somebody participate. It's fear may be one part of it, but it's more than fear. There are other factors which play into it as well. And that's a really, really challenging issue, because, of course, we'd like to think that all of the perpetrators were monsters, were inhuman. And you know, there are a small number of psychopaths or sadists, but mostly there were people just like us. And that's really, really uncomfortable.
Okay, so let's now move on to the actual final solution. So in January 1942, a group of senior Nazis met at Wannsee, a suburb of Berlin, to discuss what they called the final solution to the Jewish question. And there, Himmler, the head of the SS and the Gestapo, was put in charge of this systematic killing of all Jews within Germany and German-occupied territory. Slave labor and death camps were built at Auschwitz, Treblinka, and Chełmno in Poland, among other places. The old, the sick, and the young children were killed immediately. The rest were sent to work at the labor camps. Some were used for medical experiments. 6 million Jews, 500,000 European gypsies, and countless political prisoners, Jehovah's Witnesses, homosexuals, and Russian and Polish prisoners of war were sent to these camps, where they were either worked to death, gassed, or shot. So we've kind of had a decade of the Nazi rule up to this point, and the escalation from what we've seen at the beginning of the episode with banning of Jewish businesses and shops, to now actual labor camps, to where the survival rate was almost, what, 1 in a million. So, Charlie,
that's true.
Talk to us about the responsibility of the final solution.
Yeah, so as Martin would know, that obviously historians disagree about whether Hitler planned this, but they do obviously individually agree that Hitler was ultimately responsible. However, other individuals and organizations shared the responsibility, and this entire genocide could not have been possible without many other forces. So the civil service bureaucracy, who collected and stored and supplied information about the Jews, police forces in Germany and the Greater German Reich. So many victims of the Nazis were seized by the Gestapo and the SS. The SS itself, so Eichmann, who was in charge of this system of transporting Jews to collection points and then to death camps. So Auschwitz, Treblinka, Kelmo, Bergen-Belsen, the list is almost endless. And the Wehrmacht, which were the German armed forces, although they really did not play a part in the Holocaust itself, they were fully aware of what was going on and the immorality of what was happening. So, you know, Martin, this kind of idea was the final solution planned for the start. Historians disagree on it. You're a historian. What is your opinion on it?
Well, actually, I would say technically they used to disagree on it. There was a very big debate, particularly in the 80s, primarily in Germany, between historians about this. I mean, today, no historians argue that it was always planned. There was always the potential, but I think there's a universal agreement today that it emerged during the course of the Second World War, and particularly in the sort of second half of 1941. Whether it was inevitable in the sense that Nazi policy was always likely to lead to this is maybe a different question, but I think it's something which, in a way, the more challenging question is the one that you were alluding to earlier about who's responsible for this, because it is clearly Hitler and Himmler as the leader of the SS, but equally, as I suggested earlier, with the creation of ghettos, the decision-making processes in the Holocaust actually involved huge numbers of people. And I think that's a really important thing to bear in mind. And again, particularly because after the war, everybody said, oh, it's just Hitler. It's just the SS. And I think, again, it's easier for us to think that that's the case, to think there's just a few evil people who do evil things. Whereas in fact, you know, as you suggested, a wide range of civil servants, members of the Nazi Party, were actively involved, not just in the perpetration of the Holocaust, but in the decisions which led to it. And I would say again, a key point is that, you know, in terms of what made this possible, is it's not just Germans, as I said earlier. You mentioned police forces, for example. It wasn't just within the Reich proper. So, you know, for example, in France, even in the occupied zone of France, in northern France, it wasn't German policemen who rounded up French Jews. It was French policemen. And that is, has been in the recent past in French politics, a very contentious issue even today, that question of responsibility. So I think, you know, in a way, actually, since the 1990s, historians have actually come up with quite a clear picture of how the Holocaust evolved. Basically, during the Cold War, there was very limited access to a lot of archives. With the fall of communism, suddenly archives in Russia and Poland and elsewhere became accessible. And that enabled historians to build up a very clear picture of Nazi policy. But I think, in a way, the bigger questions today are still those ones about responsibility. And particularly, you mentioned the sort of different victim groups of Nazism. There is a difference between how Jews were treated and how other people were treated. Jews were targeted for complete annihilation, other groups were not. And I think an interesting element within that is you mentioned the Nazi camp system. There was a difference between, as it were, regular concentration camps and extermination camps. Auschwitz was unusual because it was both. But otherwise, extermination camps, Treblinka, Belzec, Sobibor, and Chełmno were places where you sent Jews to kill them, and nobody survived. I mean, collectively for those four camps, about 120 people survived out of 1.5 million. Whereas, in a way, those camps were for Jews, concentration camps were for everybody else, for political prisoners, for Roma, for enemy fighters from occupied countries. And in both of those processes, but actually particularly with the extermination camps, this might seem a bit weird, but there are questions which they raise about human nature. Because although these places to some extent were hidden away, and Himmler, as I mentioned earlier, you know, talked about trying to keep this secret. They were an open secret. People knew they existed. People who lived nearby could not avoid knowing they existed for all sorts of unpleasant reasons. So again, there are big questions that are raised there about people, really, about the people of Europe. How did they react to this? How did they react to this knowledge? And I think, in a way, those are the most interesting questions about responsibility.
There we have it. We have gone from the start of the Nazi regime in Germany, from the origins of anti-Semitism in the Nazi Party, to the Final Solution and the Holocaust. Martin, thank you so much for joining us today. We have really, really valued your time, and you've been an excellent help. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jonah. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you for having me.
And also, we thank the Holocaust Education Trust for getting
the struggles of recording on Zoom right there.
helping us get such a fantastic historian as Martin. We could, of course, talk for days about, you know, the killings and what took place in the actual concentration camps. But I think it's very important that we really discuss the history behind it. And I think it's incredibly interesting, fascinating, and spine-chilling as well. We all know what happened in the concentration camps. Women were gassed, and men were forced to do labor. But of course, that's a conversation for another day. Martin, thank you. And that's a wrap.
Thank you.